Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who explains why his group is asking the government of Germany to investigate high-ranking U.S. officials for torture and war crimes committed against prisoners of war in Iraq. Attorney Cliff Arnbeck with the Alliance for Democracy, who describes the voting irregularities in Ohio, which led him to file a lawsuit contesting the election result before the state's Supreme Court. And Robert Nave of the Connecticut Network to Abolish the Death Penalty, who discusses the campaign to stop the scheduled execution of convicted murderer Michael Ross on January 26th, in what would be Connecticut's first execution in 40 years. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
20 years after the world's worst industrial accident at the Union Carbide plant in Bhopal, India, the children continue to suffer the effects of toxic pollution. 18-year-old Shakira Asan must crawl on her hands and knees as her legs are too weak to stand on. She was born 2 years after the accident that spewed 40 tons of methyl isocyanate on the evening of December 3, 1984. Almost 10,000 poor residents of Bhopal died soon afterwards, and over 500,000 people were affected by the toxic fumes. Local health workers now tell the Associated Press that many pregnant women later suffered miscarriages. Champa Devi Shukla, who runs a women's self-help group, says that women now living near the accident site still have carcinogenic elements in their breast milk. Amnesty International has launched a global campaign to force Union Carbide, which was acquired by Dow Chemical in 2001, to pay for the full cleanup of the site's toxins. Amnesty's campaign director, Benedict Southworth, declared that Union Carbide was responsible for a litany of failures in that period leading up to the gas leak. Bhopal, he says, shows how readily some companies can evade their human rights responsibilities. Reuters reports that thousands of African villagers in the eastern Congo are fleeing their homes in what some observers see as a new round of bloody incursions into the Democratic Republic of the Congo. For weeks, there was evidence of a buildup by Rwandan troops on the border with Congo in an effort to chase down rival Hutu rebels, some of whom are implicated in Rwanda's genocide in 1994. In late November, Rwandan President Paul Kagame warned the UN Security Council and the African Union that he would send troops into eastern Congo to chase Hutu militias. The threat raised fears that the two-year-old Congo peace accord might fall apart and renew fighting that led to the death of 4 million people in the 1990s. UN peacekeepers are limited to helicopter patrols of the border area, with little power to prevent new hostilities. Various regional experts question why Rwanda is taking military action now, since the Congo peace deal is progressing and there are fewer Hutu rebels in the border region. One non-governmental organization, Global Witness, blamed Rwanda's incursion on its desire to retain control over valuable mines in the eastern Congo, which its troops overran in the late 1990s. Business executives regularly complain about the exploding cost of healthcare and its negative effect on economic growth. Yet corporate America refuses to embrace one low-cost solution, government-funded single-payer healthcare. According to The Nation magazine, most business leaders are too wedded to free market orthodoxy to see government as the solution. Universal health coverage could relieve major employers of the burden of paying medical bills under worker compensation, a $38 billion expense in 2002. And auto insurance rates would fall if insurance companies were no longer liable for medical and hospital bills. 75% of top executives in Greater Detroit called employee health care unaffordable, and 25% complained it was very unaffordable. The corporate response to increasing health care costs has been to cut worker health benefits. In 1999, Richard Weitz left the Whitman Corporation in Chicago to run the Consumer Health Care Council, with the aim of engaging employers in a serious discussion about the crisis of the uninsured. But the effort led to 4 years of frustration. As Weitz told The Nation magazine, he spent 4 years trying to get business people in the same room with single-payer people, but in the end, he was unsuccessful. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
A as more evidence, including photos, emerged documenting the abuse of prisoners in the custody of the U.S. military around the world, news reports revealed a devastating memorandum issued by the International Committee of the Red Cross. The Red Cross memo, leaked to the New York Times in late November, accused the U.S. military of using tactics tantamount to torture on prisoners held at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The charges were made by an ICRC inspection team that had spent most of June at the American base in Cuba. More than 500 prisoners, many captured during the 2001 U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, have been held at Guantanamo indefinitely without charge or access to attorneys. Meanwhile, the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights, on behalf of four Iraqi citizens who were victims of abuse, has asked the government of Germany to undertake a criminal investigation of high-ranking U.S. officials, including Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who may be culpable for torture and war crimes committed at the American-run Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. The action was taken under the doctrine of universal jurisdiction, where suspected war criminals may be prosecuted irrespective of where they reside. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a principal attorney for prisoners being held at the Guantanamo U.S. Naval Base. Ratner addresses the pattern of abuse that persists at Pentagon-run prisons and explains why his group felt it was necessary to go to Germany as a court of last resort to investigate the responsibility of Washington's political and military leadership for acts of torture and other serious war crimes carried out by lower-level personnel.
We finally turned to Germany after being utterly frustrated with what's going on in the United States on the issue of torture. I mean, it's very clear if you read all these reports, if you read the news articles, that torture that occurred at Abu Ghraib, that has occurred at Bagram in Afghanistan, that has occurred in Guantanamo, was not isolated, was not the result of seven soldiers in Abu Ghraib who decided to do sexual pyramiding, but that the authorizations for using inhuman treatment and torture went all the way up to the top. And unfortunately, our government, the Bush administration, and Congress are doing nothing about it. What they've done is try and go after seven low-level soldiers in Iraq. So there's nowhere to turn in the United States. There's no independent investigation. There's no criminal prosecution going on. So what can you do? You can turn to international courts. There's none that the United States acknowledges or recognizes. It won't join the International Criminal Court. So we started looking at countries that have what's called universal jurisdiction, that they can prosecute crimes, certain serious crimes, wherever in the world they're committed. And, of course, the first such crime in the world like that was piracy. The universal jurisdiction has now been extended from piracy to torture, and it's also gone and included now war crimes, violations of the Geneva Conventions, as well as just inhuman treatment. And Germany, as it happens, has the best single law on universal jurisdiction in the world. It's sort of ironic. It comes sort of out of their experience, I think, in the war, that they decided to assert this kind of jurisdiction. We've sued Donald Rumsfeld, sitting over here in Washington in the Department of Defense. We've also sued some people who were actually living in Germany. General Sanchez, who supervised the prisons in Iraq during the Abu Ghraib period, is head of the 5th Army Corps, which is in Heidelberg, so he's actually in Germany. Colonel Pappas, who was in charge of the Military Intelligence Brigade, also accused of, or at least alleged to have been involved in the incidents at Abu Ghraib, is also in Wiesbaden, Germany. So Germany has actually a real interest here because some of the very people who we say or allege are involved in this are actually living there. So we went over to Germany with a 160-page complaint in German, working very closely with a German lawyer named Wolfgang Kolick, who actually has been doing Argentinian cases there on the same theory. And we spent 3 days in Berlin really doing press conferences, interviews, and filing this case with the Attorney General of Germany, essentially, the chief prosecutor.
Michael Ratner, is there a smoking gun here in the Abu Ghraib case and the other allegations of torture at places like Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba, where the culpability of U.S. officials can be directly linked to the actions of soldiers in those prisons?
If you look carefully and comb the documents, you get what I would say is close to guilt on a number of different issues for some of these officials. You have Rumsfeld actually authorizing in a document that's in the Schlesinger report, the use of dogs. He says, for example, exploit phobias, e.g. dogs. That's clearly illegal, contrary not only to Geneva, but contrary to any concept of humane treatment, and constitutes torture. You have Rumsfeld saying use stress positions, sleep deprivation, temperature controls, a whole series of things. You don't need a smoking gun to say you basically got him on it. I mean, that's a war crime. You got Rumsfeld on ghost detainees at Abu Ghraib, hiding detainees, essentially so they can be dealt with by the CIA and engaging in torture. You got people saying let's not apply Geneva, essentially because, and this is what Gonzalez said, the president's counsel, who was about to be, hopefully not, but looks like they want to elevate him to attorney general, saying don't apply Geneva, and he essentially says that because interrogation prohibitions are obsolete, indicating they want to use inhumane treatment. So I can go through each one of these. Sanchez also, General Sanchez, authorized the use of dogs. There's obviously a lot more here that we don't know. We know a little bit, like one news article, a meeting in which Gonzalez participated with others, in which they approved waterboarding, which is when you push people underwater until they almost drown. This is people at the highest levels of our government discussing methods of torture. It's something I never would have thought I would have seen in the country.
What message does it send to Americans and the international community as a whole that the Bush administration would choose to nominate Alberto Gonzalez as Attorney General of the United States, a man who during his tenure as White House counsel dismissed the Geneva Conventions as, I think he put it, quaint and irrelevant in regards to the rights of prisoners of war?
Right, that's correct. He essentially authored the memo that said people could be treated inhumanely outside the conventions. He went to a meeting, as I said, that apparently approved such things as waterboarding, which is a type of torture. And the question is, what message? What message does all of the conduct the United States is doing right now send to the Muslim world and to the rest of the world? First to the Muslim world on how we treat Muslims. And that first goes from Guantanamo and, you know, people in hoods and bending over in the hot sun with a marine over them, then to torture of Muslim people in Abu Ghraib, then to bombing the heck out of Iraq and leveling Fallujah, then to essentially elevating to the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez, author of at least one or two, actually, of these infamous memos, and thinking that he's going to slide through the Senate now on confirmation. What legal or moral or political authority do we have left when they behead American soldiers, when we are undertaking conduct of torture and others, and then elevating some of the architects of it?
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464. Letters can be sent to Germany in support of the litigation by visiting the center's website at www.ccr-ny.org. Michael Ratner is co-author, along with Ellen Ray, of the book Guantanamo: What the World Should Know. After a series of citizen-initiated hearings, protests, and independent investigations into voting irregularities in Ohio, Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell certified the results of Ohio's November 2nd presidential election, declaring George W. Bush the winner over John Kerry by a margin of 119,000 votes. However, critics immediately launched two separate challenges against the official tally. The Green and Libertarian parties jointly filed a request for a recount of the votes cast in all of Ohio's 88 counties, backed by $113,000 raised to pay required state fees. Attorney Cliff Arnbeck, representing the Alliance for Democracy and 25 Ohio voters, will file a lawsuit with the Ohio Supreme Court contesting the validity of the state's election results based on documented cases of voter suppression, miscounts of thousands of votes, and a pattern of shortages of voting machines in predominantly African-American precincts. In addition, Democratic Representative John Conyers of Michigan convened a hearing December 8th to investigate voting irregularities in Ohio, backed by outgoing Democratic National Committee Chair Terry McAuliffe, who called for a study of the problems experienced by voters there. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with attorney Cliff Arnbeck, who describes the evidence of voting irregularities which led him to file a lawsuit before Ohio Supreme Court and the potential for overturning the results of the national election.
Citizen groups here in Ohio have been raising questions about the irregularities that occurred in this election. And there are two procedures under Ohio law for challenging an after-election challenge. Both of them actually are supposed to commence after the certification of the election by the Secretary of State. The Green Party candidate and Libertarian Party candidate will file a request for a recount. recount on a statewide basis. Also, on behalf of 25 voters, we will be filing a election contest. And this is more like a conventional litigation in a special statutory procedure before the Ohio Supreme Court. And in that process, we will conduct discovery and seek to prove that the irregularities in this election, if corrected, would produce a different result, and indeed that John Kerry was the person who Ohioans voted for.
Cliff, if you could just specify some of the outstanding irregularities and allegations of vote fraud or machine breakdown that have caused you to take this action with the lawsuit.
There are many, many, many things that have come out in public hearings that we've had around the state. These are organized by citizens, but testimony given under oath and affidavits executed by citizens to describe the problems. There was an election protection group here funded or sponsored by a number of public interest organizations, which literally created a record of some 10,000 incidents of violation of voter rights on Election Day here in Ohio. All of this is an important record, and we intend to honor that record by referring to this various evidence in the course of this case. One of the most shocking things about what happened in Ohio is how blatant the attack was upon black citizens, black precincts, and impairing their right to vote, either through shorting them on machines so that they were facing lines and waiting times that were quite unreasonable, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, and also targeting university students often voting for the first time. These were population groups that had been developed quite aggressively in terms of developing voter interest and voter registration and voter participation. Republicans knew that this was going to be a problem for them, and all this voter suppression activity would appear to be a response to try to deal with that. However, as we examined, did various statistical analyses of the vote, the real manipulation of this election seems to have occurred in southern Ohio, several southern Ohio counties, where votes were simply moved from the Kerry column to the Bush column. And that's what we're going to focus on, because that's where the big payoff is, that if we can prove that by clear and convincing evidence, there are enough votes in that manipulation to reverse the result of the election.
Could you go into that in a little bit more detail? How were the votes moved from one column to the other in southern Ohio, as you just stated?
I'm not a technical person in terms of the actual way that was done, but that will be the purpose of discovery, to determine exactly how that was done. We find a pattern of anomaly, statistical anomaly, which we do not think can be explained in any other way than an illegal moving of votes. Of course, the real thing we need is to get in and look at the actual votes, which we can do both by the recount and by the contest.
Cliff, where do you want this lawsuit to take you in terms of either investigating what happened, investigating the allegations of fraud, or otherwise overturning the results in terms of the winner?
Because of the compressed time frame and the fact that we must respect the date as of which the electoral votes will be counted in Congress, January 6th, I think it is, we have a very tight time schedule. So one of our initial requirements is to get the court to agree to accelerate the normal contest time frame. Same problem exists with respect to the recount. A manual recount across the state could extend beyond this deadline. So what we hope is that both political parties will say that it's imperative for our nation to have confidence in the honesty of its elections. And if there's any question, that question should be resolved in an honest, forthright way. If wrongdoing has been done, it should be identified, it should be corrected, and we should certify a correct result for the election. This is important for our ability to have confidence in our leadership in this nation, both domestically and in our foreign affairs.
That was Attorney Cliff Arnbeck, representing the Alliance for Democracy and 25 Ohio voters in a lawsuit before the state Supreme Court. For more information, visit the Alliance website at www.thealliancefordemocracy.org or Free Press, the Ohio-based online investigative magazine, at www.freepress.org. On January 26, 2005, the state of Connecticut is set to execute its first death row prisoner in 40 years. Michael Ross, 45, has admitted raping and strangling 8 young women in the early 1980s. Republican Governor Jody Rell declined to postpone this execution until after the state's next legislative session, which would have allowed legislators to debate and possibly pass a bill abolishing capital punishment. Now it appears that the only thing that can save Ross is if the death row inmate reverses his position on wanting to be executed and initiates new appeals, or his former attorneys succeed in persuading a judge that he was not competent to make decisions related to his case. 12 states, including 4 in New England, have banned the death penalty. In a 2003 poll, Connecticut residents favored the death penalty 60% to 34%. But when the choice is execution or life without parole, less than half supported capital punishment. Support for the death penalty in the U.S. has dropped from a high of 80% in 1994 to 70% this year. But again, when the option of life in prison without parole is offered as an alternative, support for the death penalty drops to 50%. Capital punishment, long banned in developed nations around the world, has been criticized in the U.S. for being racially, economically, and geographically discriminatory, disproportionately affecting people of color and the poor, who are often denied adequate legal representation. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Robert Nave, director of the Connecticut Network to Abolish the Death Penalty and Amnesty International's Death Penalty Abolition Coordinator in the state. Nave talks about why he opposes capital punishment and what his group and others are doing to outlaw the death penalty in Connecticut.
When an execution occurs, it is two things. It is murder, and it is murder in your name. And that's exactly what is going to happen here in Connecticut. The state of Connecticut is going to murder, because on the death certificate of all people who are executed, the cause of death is called homicide. The death penalty was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States in 1972 in a case called Furman versus Georgia. They called it freakish and arbitrary, and they overturned it, and they told the states to rewrite their laws. Well, Connecticut did rewrite our laws by 1973, and we've had the death penalty on the books for 31 years, and we have sentenced 10 people total to death. 8 currently sit on death row. One was taken off of death row because it was found that he should not have even been prosecuted for death. And then the other gentleman was taken off of death row because the prosecutor in the case acted so egregiously in front of the jury that the Supreme Court struck down the sentence. Plus, as it turns out, the judge did not even instruct the jury correctly on how to sentence in a death case. And that just shows how flawed our judicial system is in so many ways, that we cannot trust a judicial system to send only guilty people to their death, as 117 people nationwide have been exonerated from death rows in the past 30 years due to innocence.
Michael Ross is not a very sympathetic poster boy for ending the death penalty. He's white and highly educated, having committed multiple heinous crimes that he has admitted to. In other words, there is no chance that he is innocent of these crimes.
First of all, we have to be very clear. We are not advocates for people like Michael Ross. We're not advocates for those on death row. What we are advocates against is poor public policy. We do not like poor public policy, and that is what the death penalty is, poor public policy. And when it comes to people like Michael Ross, yes, what they did was extraordinarily heinous. And our sympathies do go out to the families of all of his victims. And a way to honor their death, their life, and their memory, we choose not to honor it through continued murder and violence. We choose another route, which is, I believe, much more civilized. And that is not the death penalty.
So what you're saying is that in these cases, you would support life in prison without possibility of parole?
In some cases, life without parole would be more appropriate than life, which is not necessarily forever. Life without parole may be needed in some cases, absolutely. In the case of Mr. Ross, people get confused. They mix up mental retardation and mental illness. Michael Ross is not mentally retarded. Michael Ross is a very intelligent and extremely articulate man. And unfortunately, because people have seen that, they say, well, he should know better, he is inherently evil, and therefore he must die. The whole concept of mental illness is so misunderstood by the public. When it comes to mental illness, there is no control over a person's actions very often. And Mr. Ross is severely and profoundly mentally ill. He suffers from several and varied profound mental illnesses, the chief of which is sexual sadism, a diagnosable and recognizable and recognized mental illness by the American Psychiatric Association.
What is your group trying to do to prevent this execution?
We are working towards getting the legislature to look at this, either pre- or post-execution. We've been trying this for years, but because it's a political hot potato, people are very leery of this, those who are elected to office. However, the time has come because we are about to murder in the name of the state of Connecticut. So the legislature is looking at this, but furthermore, since Mr. Ross is volunteering, are we helping somebody commit state-sponsored suicide? Jack Kevorkian sits in jail right now for helping people commit suicide who were terminally ill. He is in jail for that, theoretically speaking. Since the state is helping Michael Ross commit suicide, should we all be in jail because we are responsible for this act of assisted suicide?
If this execution goes forward, since Connecticut hasn't had one in so long, what would be the form of execution?
The form of execution in Connecticut is lethal injection, and the process is carried out at 2:01 a.m., and I would ask, if this was not poor public policy, why is it carried out in the middle of the night? Why is it that we don't see this firsthand? Why is it that we don't know who the execution team is? Why is it that we don't know who pushes the button starting the lethal injection? But the fact remains that we will not know most of this. We are going to try to find out all of this. Toxicology reports are showing that in many cases, people are not asleep during this process. It could take as long as half an hour. Those who witness will just see a person laying perfectly still, when in actuality, he may be alive and being tortured during that entire time. And if anybody thinks that torture is acceptable for anybody, that is a gross human rights violation. Torture is unacceptable, period.
That was Robert Nave of the Connecticut Network to Abolish the Death Penalty. Contact the network by calling area code 203-206-9854 or visit their website at www.cnadp.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.